This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the Buick Enclave, the finest luxury crossover ever. Visit buick.gm.ca to see that where there's passion, there's beauty.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Edition podcast for October 28th, 2007. I'm Michael Enright. This week, Karen Wells's examination of the abuse of the elderly in her documentary These Things Happen, and some thoughts on the rising loony and cross-border gouging. But first, from last week's program, Frank Falk finds the healing power of one musical instrument in Straight from the Harp. In Greek lore, even the rocks were moved to tears when Orpheus played his harp. In the Old Testament, David plucked the instrument to rid King Saul of depression. And in the Middle Ages, monks ushered the souls of the dying to heaven with its music. But the harp can do a lot more than lift spirits and bring calm to troubled souls. It is now being used in the management of physical pain. Just a couple of months ago, the Hawkesbury District General Hospital, a 69-bed regional facility halfway between Ottawa and Montreal, became the first hospital in North America to offer vibroacoustic harp therapy. Frank Falk went there to find out why. Here is Straight from the Harp.
Okay. Now, Mr. Curtis, last time you said you didn't want as much sound up around your head, that you wanted it more down your back. So I've made a volume adjustment, okay? And we'll see if that works better for you. So I'm going to give you a big zing just to make sure everything's feeling all right in there.
Leslie Curtis is 76 years old and suffers from lymphoma. Dressed in loose-fitting pajamas, he's lying on what looks like a massage table. Ian Hepburn sits a few feet from him, beside a concert-sized pedal harp. It's painted black and fitted with small microphones along its strings. At its base is an electric cord that's plugged into speakers attached to the underside of the table. Just a week ago, Mr. Curtis had his first session of vibroacoustic harp therapy for pain in his stomach, hip, and thighs, pain that left him restless and anxious. Afterwards, the soreness and anxiety were both reduced. Now, 10 minutes into a second session, Mr. Curtis has again found some relief.
When I do this in the hospital, even if I'm just playing in the hallways and people will, you know, I'll describe that somebody has fallen sound asleep and somebody will say, well, doesn't that insult you? I say, absolutely not. I mean, this could be the greatest gift you could give somebody, that they could actually sleep. They may not have been able to sleep for the last 2 or 3 days, and here it is, they're sound asleep. So now that's great.
Ian Hepburn's love affair with a harp began a long way from hospital corridors. At music festivals, church basements, and concert halls, he was an accomplished pianist in a Celtic music group. The band needed a harp player, so Ian decided to take up the instrument himself. And for a decade, he played it on the road. But a couple of years ago, he found himself tired of travel and the whole industry scene. He began to look for another place to play his harp, another way to be a musician. Ian lives just a few miles from the Hawkesbury and District General Hospital. So he volunteered his services there and was soon giving mini concerts in the hallway every Sunday.
There was that aspect of, you know, bringing a bit of hope or lightness to people's lives, and, you know, the nurses always say they love when I come in because it brings calmness to the floor.
The harp has long been a popular instrument in palliative care and in the treatment of anxiety. But in 2005, at a Salt Lake City conference on the use of the harp in therapeutic settings, Ian Hepburn heard about a workshop on physical pain and pain relief. He was intrigued and skeptical. The workshop leader was Sarah Jane Williams, nurse, psychologist, professional harpist, and the pioneer of vibroacoustic harp therapy. In 1989, Sarah Jane Williams worked in a pain clinic at St. Luke's Hospital in Philadelphia. The clinic explored a wide range of experimental methods, biofeedback, acupuncture, and flotation tanks. Sarah Jane's job was to operate a strange-looking contraption called the Genesis Bioacoustic Sound System.
It was like a geodesic dome that had a bed in the middle of it, and the patient would lie on this, and it was surrounded by speakers. We played CDs through the computer console, but what I felt was lacking was my inability to interact with the patient more and make the music specific to the patient's needs. So one day, I took my harp to work and plugged in my pickup, which is a microphone on the harp. I found that each tone resonated in a distinct area of the patient's body, and then I could improvise music that was tailored to the need of the patient. The basic principles behind using sound vibration are that when sound enters the body, it stimulates certain brain structures, and that can affect your emotions and your memory. It can affect the way your body and your heart rate and your blood pressure respond to the rhythms that surround the body. It can produce different biochemicals that make you feel relaxed and reduce pain. And sometimes when you're responding to a pain signal, the vibratory stimulation kind of competes with that signal that's sent to the brain, so it kind of overrides it. Another way of understanding how vibration works in relieving pain is that each area of the body, each tissue, resonates at a different frequency, so that if, for instance, if I pluck a middle C, it might resonate in your stomach. If I pluck a C an octave below that, it might be in your legs.
At the conference in Salt Lake City, Ian watched Sarah Jane demonstrate vibroacoustic harp therapy on two women. One suffered from intense back pain. The other had lingering pain in her shoulder from a car accident. Both reported a radical reduction in pain. When Sarah Jane announced that she'd give a session later in the day to anyone interested in having the experience for themselves, Ian jumped at the chance.
I went to the room that was designated. I walked in and Sarah Jane greeted me and she said, "So where's your pain?" And I said, "I have no pain." And so she said, "Well, then why are you here?" And I said, "Because I didn't believe anything that I saw. And I want to feel what they felt when they lay down on that mat." And she said, "Well, that's fair enough." So she had me lie down on the mat. And she said, "Well, you know what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be playing individual notes. So you tell me what you're feeling, if you're feeling anything." So the very first note that she played was middle C. And as soon as she plucked it, I could not believe what I was experiencing. My thumbs vibrated so strongly, I thought they were going to come right out of their sockets. So I just said, "Wow." So she said, "Well, all right, let's go to the next note." And it was amazing because that vibration then moved up to, let's say, slightly above my wrist. And every note that she proceeded down that scale went up my arm, across my shoulders, and down my spine in a very, very organized way. I was amazed at how it was like pinpoint accuracy right down, outlining the shape of my body and my spine. By the end of the session, it was so clear to me what the applications of this could be. And as quickly as I could, I made my way to the hospital, Hawkesbury and District, and I went to Claire Diamond, who I'd known for a couple of years. I stormed into her office and said, "This is just the most amazing thing I've ever seen. It is truly incredible."
This hospital really welcomed new ideas. Our physiotherapists go for extensive training in acupuncture, and they can offer this as well to our patients.
Claire Diamond is coordinator of community relations at the Hawkesbury and District General Hospital.
I asked them immediately to send me some documentation on this, to sort of corroborate what he was talking about. Because in this area, we do not have pain control clinics, it seemed to be quite exciting to read about something like a therapy that was not invasive.
Immediately, it caught my interest. I come from a musical family, and I thought if there's any therapy that can be given to our patients using music, I was immediately open to that. We knew already that Ian, with his, I call them corridor concerts, that we could go further and use the principle of vibroacoustic harp therapy. I was open immediately to at least hearing Sarah Jane.
Dr. Jean Fairfield is chief of staff at the hospital. In November of 2005, he arranged for Sarah Jane Williams to come there and demonstrate her work to an audience of doctors, nurses, and support staff. Dr. Fairfield also wanted to try out vibroacoustic harp therapy for himself.
It was amazing how relaxing it was, and it occurred to me very quickly that some of these notes I could only hear, and oddly, occasional notes I would feel in different parts of my body. Were there tissues that would respond differently based on the density of water? I'm not trying to invent anything here, but however, we know that the body is mostly water. Sarah Jane Williams, when she was here, she showed us some experiments by some musicians who do vibration therapy, showing us how water in a vase responds to various notes, and how the water responds was just amazing. What we saw were waves on that on the water. I can recall drops popping up, all kinds of things happening because of different notes, and there was a variety of responses. And it reminds me of how my body responded differently to different notes. I remember clearly one lady who had advanced cancer. She had multiple metastases to her bones. She was receiving morphine for the control of pain. And although she had some relief, there was much anxiety related to her condition. And she did suffer also physically. There was not perfect control of pain. And again, after her treatment, she stated herself that she had not felt as well as she did at that moment for weeks and weeks. Clearly, when we had made the decision that we wanted to go ahead with such a project, it was obvious for me that we would try to obtain protocols from other hospitals in the States that probably do this form of therapy.
Protocol was a really big issue. And it was at that point, it was actually a kind of an amusing incident, because as we were getting close to the final committee, which I think was the medical advisory committee, was the final committee that this had to go through for approval. Claire had emailed me asking me if I would get in touch with Sarah Jane down in the States to find out what hospitals were already using vibroacoustic harp therapy. She didn't explain to me why, but I figured it probably because of the issue of insurance and protocol and so on. And so I got in touch with Sarah Jane, and I just said that Claire would like to know, you know, if was there a list of hospitals in the States that were already providing this therapy? And Sarah Jane replied almost immediately, "No, you're the first ones." So I sent an email to Claire, and I said, "Isn't this exciting? This is probably not the answer that you're expecting, but we are going to be the first hospital." And I thought, this is not good.
When I heard that we would be the first hospital, this was very alarming to us. We're not used to initiating things and in this area of the province, and so we were a bit taken back by the fact that we were the first hospital to initiate such a program.
So a little bit of a gulp at that time, I remember. But that was not an obstacle. If it's not been done elsewhere, we'll do it here. Hospitals in the United States were probably not keen to start this type of therapy rapidly because of concerns with respect to medical legal aspects of therapy. I think if patients are well informed, if patients understand that they will not be cured by this process, that what we're aiming for is relief of pain, of anxiety, that we take precautions in making sure that they are not patients that have contraindications, for example, epilepsy as one contraindication for treatment with vibroacoustic therapy. Another contraindication would be the treatment of patients who have had a psychotic disorder in the past or who are actively psychotic at the time of therapy. If we're careful, I think in the end, the fear of medical legal actions, if anything should happen with this type of therapy, is not foremost on our mind.
I just don't feel like wasting my energy on being crabby. What's the point? I've been like this for years now.
All right, so good attitude. All right, any other comments?
Amanda Habick's like youthful skin and bright eyes are at odds with her slight stoop and the cane she uses to help her walk. She's 25 years old, and relentless pain has plagued her since a back operation a few years ago. On top of that, she's been diagnosed with fibromyalgia, and she's tried just about everything to get the pain under control.
I will get aches in my face. I'll feel like somebody smashed me in my jaw all night where I won't be able to sleep, or my legs will cramp, and I'll get sciatic pain down both my legs all night. It just doesn't stop. The medications that I personally take have really taken a toll on me cognitively. I wouldn't be surprised if I have permanent memory damage now, because I can't remember many things. I can't perform many tasks, and that's just the way it is for me.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to start by going through sort of a checklist of how you're feeling, how your body's feeling right now. Not this morning or last week, but right now. So on a scale of 1 to 9, 1 being very relaxed, 9 being tense and painful, how would you relate the state right now of your hands and arms?
At about a 4.
Your face?
9.
So you have a lot of pain there.
Yes.
Most sessions are about half an hour long, okay, so and patients say that relief from pain lasts anywhere from the duration of the session to a few days following a treatment.
That felt even more dispersed into my muscles in the same area almost. I can't explain it.
Are these good sensations?
These are all good sensations. They feel very good. Ooh, I feel something in my left butt and cheek, sorry, and it doesn't feel very good.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah. Many patients have said to me, you know, I felt that you were playing for me. You know, this was my own piece of music, which is the truth. It is, because I'm basing that whatever I'm playing around those tones that are affecting their body. It really is their piece of music.
Like I'm floating on a cloud right now. Seriously. I feel much better than when I started.
So Amanda, just to go back through the 1 to 9 thing that we did at the beginning, how, on a scale of 1 to 9, 1 being very relaxed, 9 being very tense and painful, how do you feel with your hands and arms?
I'd say about a 2.
Face, that was a big one for you.
That's about a 6.
Head.
That's about a 6.
Neck. I think there's another really interesting aspect here that gets into the area of, I suppose, the psychology of the patient. And that is the very question of why the harp? Why not the cello? Why not a guitar? Why the harp? Well, I suppose the simple answer to that is that the harp has a very, very wide range of pitch, so that the frequencies that are available to a harp are really great, larger than probably any other instrument other than, I suppose, the piano or an organ. But there's another aspect to the harp that goes way beyond that. It's almost like a primordial recognition of the harp. And that undoubtedly goes into our Judeo-Christian aspect of thinking of harps being associated with angels. But the interesting thing is that harps have been found through all cultures throughout the world, throughout all time. So it's not just angels, although we have that. Also, the harp is a very beautiful instrument just to look at. People in pain, or if they're in tension, if they're suffering, it opens and gives an accessibility that already makes it possible to establish communication with them.
Of course, it's not surprising that practitioners of vibroacoustic harp therapy are convinced of its value in the treatment of pain. But what about the real science of it? Hard data. There have been some preliminary studies on the use of live harp music in clinical settings to reduce pain and anxiety. And the National Institutes of Health in the States are proceeding with a major study about the impact of vibrations on physiological processes. But vibroacoustic harp therapy is new and lacks a solid body of scientific research to back it up. Meanwhile, at the Hawkesbury and District General Hospital, the medical staff is grateful for any new way to alleviate suffering, hopeful about the long-term results, and for now, happy to be on the cutting edge.
I think in the end it will be possible to have some type of objective results, but on the long term, my gut feeling is we will progress as rapidly as the success is obvious to patients and family.
For the Sunday edition, I'm Frank Falk in Hawkesbury, Ontario.
You are listening to the Sunday edition podcast. I'm Michael Enright. Gateway Sports is a recreational vehicle dealership in Grand Forks, North Dakota, owned and operated by a jovial private enterpriser named Ron Thompson. In the spring and summer, he makes his living selling Sea-Doos and all-terrain vehicles. In the wintertime, of which there's quite a lot in North Dakota, he sells the very popular Ski-Doos made by the Quebec company Bombardier. Americans love his snow machines, as do Canadians. As a matter of fact, Canadians from north of the border, especially Manitoba, have been traveling to Grand Forks to buy their snowmobiles at Gateway. The reason for the pilgrimage is all about the Canadian dollar and saving money. The loonie, now resting comfortably at par with the U.S. greenback, or a bit ahead, means greater savings for Canadian purchasers in the United States. As Ron Thompson points out, the Bombardier Renegade X800 model sells for about $13,000 to $14,000 in Manitoba, but only $10,000 U.S. in North Dakota. Mr. Thompson loved to see those Manitoba license plates, but he had a sinking feeling that things were too good to last, and he was right. He recently received orders from Bombardier telling him not to sell any snowmobiles, or any machines for that matter, to visiting Canadians. This left Mr. Thompson fuming on a number of fronts. He scoffs, for example, at the Bombardier explanation that it is trying to protect Canadian dealers. He wonders why, when the loonie was worth 70 cents U.S. and Americans were streaming north to buy, Bombardier wasn't protecting his interests. Also, he is paying about $5,000 a month on his inventory, and he's being prohibited from selling to Canadians to help his bottom line. It's a virus that is spreading. General Motors has told its dealers in U.S. border communities that they are not allowed to sell its cars to Canadians, that if they do, they risk their entire franchise agreement with GM, and further, that the warranties on the cars probably would not be recognized. There is one other feature that is particularly galling about the actions taken by Bombardier. Over the past several decades, it has received more government handouts than any other company in Canada. These handouts are in the form of government loans, loan guarantees, direct subsidies and tax credits. The money runs into the hundreds of millions of dollars. So much so that the Canadian Taxpayers Federation once called Bombardier a welfare sinkhole. Quote, "The Bombardier group of companies," the Federation said, "has been the largest beneficiary of the federal government's corporate welfare program," end quote. On top of the direct payments, there are so-called repayable contributions. But as the Taxpayers Federation points out, these repayable monies are hardly ever repaid, that is. So here's the play. A company heavily subsidized by Canadian taxpayers is charging Canadians who live where the products are made an awful lot more than they are selling for in the U.S., and is trying to stop those same subsidizing Canadians from trying to save a little bit of money. Jim Flaherty, the federal finance minister, this week exhorted retailers to reduce their prices to consumers given the unexpected rise in the dollar. "It's only fair," he said. Now maybe he could send his message to industry, beginning with Bombardier. I'm Michael Enright, and you are listening to the Sunday Edition podcast. There's a story that they tell at the Kirby Seniors Center in Calgary. The police got a call. Neighbors were worried that a man down the street was beating his wife. When police arrived at the door, the wife in question led them inside and then downstairs to the basement. She showed them a room with a padlock. Inside, there was a mattress and a bucket. It was the room where her husband kept her prisoner. No one could quite believe it. She was 80 years old. But where to take an 80-year-old abused woman? Women's shelters are noisy and frenetic, often full of young children, and they're nearly always full. Fortunately, this was Calgary, the most progressive city on the continent when it comes to elder abuse. Calgary has the Kirby Shelter, the only shelter for over 60s in Canada. They take both men and women. Overseeing it all is Brenda Hill, there since the shelter opened. Here is Karen Wells' documentary, These Things Happen.
On the table out there, and she quickly...
Good morning.
Hello.
This is George.
Karen.
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
And how many people, George, you know, are in your situation who are out there who have absolutely no idea?
Lots.
Yeah.
I was a bus driver. Yes. And I retired, and I'm enjoying myself, and the wife's enjoying herself. I have two boys, and I have one girl. We enjoyed our life. And then I had a little bit of trouble at the house with my son.
How long have you been here at the shelter?
Let's see, 7 weeks. 7 weeks by Monday. And I've enjoyed it. I haven't enjoyed the fact that I haven't got my wife here. She's in the hospital because I got a suite upstairs for two beds and stuff like that for us both. Come on.
Thank you.
This is the main place here. This is where the girls are. If we want something, we got to come and ask them there.
This is not something that just happens to certain people. This can happen to anybody. We don't want to believe that your 60-year-old son is going to shove you down a set of steps or hit you or lock you in a basement room and not get your medication. And these things happen. These things are happening every day.
And this is where we come to eat.
There's lots of light, isn't there?
There's a lot of light, yeah. A lot of space. You're not crowded. Every bathroom's got a handrail on that.
When we developed this shelter, one of the things that was really a big part of it was to make it calm and quiet and peaceful. And this is why I say older people need their own shelter, so that people would have an opportunity to really examine what was going on in their lives and what kind of life they wanted to have.
Well, this is great. My daughter found it for sure. We come and talk to Brenda, we talk to You can stay here for, she says, for 21 days. We won't charge you a cent. Then she says you're going to have to pay so much money a month. It was only 800, that's all. 800.
You're going to be in trouble. Then you come here. I'll take you to the top floor now.
With older people, they have a reticence to share the kinds of issues that they have in their families.
The rooms are like, and there's teddy bear in every room here. Brenda downstairs, she likes the teddy bears. What brought me here? The fact that my son went on drugs. He went on hard drugs. I think the last 9 months that we were at the house there, he just stole everything I had. He would wait till evening and then go in my bedroom and take my banking card and go and get some money for his drugs. We didn't realize it until my daughter came here and she said, Dad, how come you're losing $100 a day? $100 a day he took out of the bank, at least 100. But with about $28,000, I think, we had total that he disappeared with, so... And we had to start all over again. And it's the drugs, it's not the kid, it's the drugs, you know.
One of the struggles is when the abuser is the adult child. It's not only spouses. And it's so very difficult to think of severing that relationship. Because many times the reasons why the abuse is happening is because there's some kind of addiction issue or some kind of mental health issue. The thought of that family relationship being gone, just not fathomable.
We don't know nothing about drugs, and we don't want to fight, with the family. We like our families. It's ours. And I don't know. I just shocked.
The split of those who come seeking shelter is about 50-50.
He had quite a temper. He had my dad's temper.
50% spouses and 50% adult children as the abusers.
We were scared. Shook me up. I was shaking like heck in the mornings and stuff, you know. So I want to get away from him because he could easily, in a temper, accidentally knock one of us down the stairs or something. By accident, I don't think he would do it deliberately. So I didn't think I'd ever move from the house. Neither did my wife. But I didn't want to leave. I did not want to leave. But we had to leave. That's it. With the drugs, we couldn't trust him. We thought he was going to be us for life, you know. A little bit we got left. Yeah. He was the baby. Quite a baby, but he was the baby, so...
How old are you now, George?
I was born in 24. Yeah, 83, yeah. And I'm doing fine, you know. And I'm quite pleased with this place, I'm telling you. They guard you like you're, I don't know. It's fabulous here, really, to be honest with you. They check blankets and that every week, right. Which is very nice, you know.
And you have peace of mind.
Yeah, all right. And no worry. And we're locked in here. So they know where I'm going or what I'm doing, or they ask. Unless I let them know.
The people that we're serving here are people who could live in the community. They aren't people who are in nursing homes or institutions or hospitals. This is the older lady that lives next door to you. It's the older gentleman who you sit next to at church services. These are people who are out and about in the community, who are able to look after themselves. We're only serving such a small percentage of the people who need this kinds of service.
George was saying he's locked in and he likes it.
Yeah.
The bad guys are locked out, George.
Yeah.
That's the way it is.
That's the way it goes. Yeah.
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 You can come and go when you want.
Yeah.
We don't quite sometimes fathom what people's lives are like. I've seen almost payback. That whole idea of my childhood or my life growing up was made awful by the abuse of my family. And I've also seen spouses who were abused, who now abuse. Well, I had this this gentleman that had a significant health problem, but he had been a big, strong man. And when his health started to fail, he had to use a walking aid. And his wife, who had been abused and hit and hospitalized for many years, started to knock the cane out from under him as he was going down the stairs. And he was definitely being abused. This was, you know, you put me through this all my life, and now it's your turn. Okay.
Here's the seat, by the way. And I'm giving Karen to you, Deborah.
Okay.
Because this is Deborah's group.
Hi.
Last
year we started what we call our sharing circle, which is a follow-up group for people who have moved from the shelter into community living. And that's usually into subsidized seniors' apartments.
I'll write it out for you.
You do that, Brenda.
You got your haircut. So I'm Deborah. This is
Karen.
Karen. It's France.
Hello.
Jane. Mary. Marie.
Hello.
And then we're going to get Caroline.
Hey, Mary.
Yes, I'm slow.
No, you're all good, sweetie.
I didn't bring my walker.
We've got spinach salad. We've got vegetarian lasagna. And we've got split pea soup and blueberry cornmeal muffins. Those recipes are favorites, usually of the group. Thanks, ladies.
There's so many what I would call success stories, and we get to see that after people leave, they come and check in. But we had this Asian woman here who only spoke very little English, and she had been abused by her husband, abused by her adult children. I would say to her, come and eat with us. And there was this reticence, and I couldn't quite figure it out. This lady had never in her entire life eaten with other people. She had always cooked the meals, served the meals, and then eaten what was left in the kitchen, and was so surprised that the people that worked here and the people that lived here sat down and ate dinner together. And she has, you know, gone on and she's gone to English as a second language, and her English is great, and she has her own car and her little apartment and doing wonderfully well. When you see that change in people, it's amazing.
Cottage cheese. I'm on the veggie lasagna.
Did you get the cottage cheese?
Not yet. I was here January, February, March, and April. 4 months.
And she came with a Samsonite suitcase full of medications. She was barely able to stand up and speak.
I heard about this place through a doctor at an emergency ward. I'd gone there because of some strife that my husband and I had, and he was the first person that had actually mentioned this place. I'd been in an abusive situation for 30 years.
Because she had lived so long in this environment where she was not allowed to speak.
I'd worked all my life, but I had just eventually came so that I wouldn't even leave the house. And then it got so I didn't even want to leave my bed. I'd really given up hope that anything could be different.
The only place she was allowed to go was the doctor's office, and every time she went to the doctor's office, they prescribed her pills. Her husband was sitting next to her through every visit, and she was afraid to speak.
It was almost impossible to leave somebody who had convinced me that I would never survive on my own. my husband and I started kind of having some rows again, and I'd taken a kitchen knife, I'd taken it and plunged it into the living room sofa, and so he'd called the police. All that pent-up anger for all the years, I think, finally just came through. They basically demanded that somebody leave the house, and that was going to be me. So they came down and picked me up, and a few days later I was in here.
And this is a woman who now, 3 years later, you know, has two bottles of medication instead of a Samsonite suitcase, and she comes to the sharing circle. She is just living the life that she never ever thought she would have. One of the things that can give that little extra push to move is they finally get their old age pension. And they finally have money that's coming in their own name. They have never, ever had that option. Many of these women are women who had young children and likely would have sought help when the children were young.
Like I just thought he had some mental health issues, which he does. He's under psychiatric care. He's a professional engineer. Like, he's very respected.
However, we're talking 40 years ago. We're talking about before women's shelters were ever built.
And his behaviors were getting just more and more bizarre, where it got to a point where I was afraid to go to bed at night. Like, he would sometimes go out the door wearing my clothes. And, I mean, I'm a small person.
They might have said, I need some help. And so they went maybe to their local minister or their priest or their mother. And we're given that answer, you know, you need to try harder. He's a good provider. You know, you should be happy that you're provided for. And so people are saying there's something wrong with you because you want out of it.
I mean, I'm from the old school. A marriage is you help one another. It's a partnership. And if he's ill, I want to be there for him.
We're working with a population that has those traditional values about the roles of men and women and roles within a marriage.
I started going for therapy myself because I got to a point where I doubted my own sanity. When I told her what was going on, what was happening, she kept saying, you know, you need to have a safety plan. You need to get out of there. The situation you're in is crazy, and it sounds like it could be very dangerous. She kept after me to have a safety plan, keep my keys, my purse, and everything in a safe in a place. I mean, this was an ongoing thing, too, where he did self-mutilate a lot. He had irritable bowel syndrome. And he was not capable of ever cleaning up after himself. So I did all that kind of stuff. Anyway, that I just thought, I can't do this anymore. Something just kind of snapped in me, and I thought, I just can't do it anymore. When I got upset like that, and he seemed to really like that, it was really scary. And he seemed to really like all the attention. And I just said, you know, I've got to get away for a couple of days. I just need time to think. So I packed a little suitcase, just got on the bus and went to my friends. I couldn't see myself going to, you know, I'd heard of abuse shelters, but I didn't really think of myself as being abused. I suddenly thought about Kirby here because I take painting classes here and there's a shelter, yeah. And I thought, well, this might be a better option than some of the other abuse shelters where they have children and street people and people that I just wouldn't relate with, you know. So that's kind of how I got in here and found out I was an abused woman.
May I ask you how old you are?
I'm 67.
People don't want to know. They're not interested. And when you do tell them about it, they're quite surprised because they don't want to know that older people can be abused. No, truthfully, people don't want to know. I'm 68 and I'm going forward. And that's what it's about. You slip on your buns, but you know, without the group here, this is the fun because we laugh together and we, you know, we cry together and we share and we know we have something in common.
And I wish to God that they would have them all over the place. They've taught me a lot of things, and I've learned how to say no for the first time of my life. So it's not all unhappiness in our life now. No. Life is a lot better.
I never thought a place like this existed. I thought, this is great, absolutely. Like I said, they're so good to you that you don't want to leave, but you want to leave for a home, that's all. Yeah, this is a godsend, this place, I'll tell you. Yeah, 24 hours, yeah. There's somebody here and watch us and help us. They do lots for me. In fact, they're always asking, can we do something for you?
And it's lunchtime, you know, so yeah. If you want to have a bite of lunch.
These Things Happen was produced by Karen Wells. The Sunday Edition podcast is available every Monday. You can download it at cbc.ca/podcasting. We're on the radio every Sunday on CBC Radio 1, beginning at 9:11, and on Sirius Satellite Radio Channel 137. Thanks for listening. I'm Michael Enright.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.